So, if I'm not wrong, you just came back from a few gigs in festivals?
Yeah, we had a couple the other weekend. Yeah, we've just done a UK album tour, a European album tour, and we've just done a few festivals, and then in a week we go to America with Royal Blood.
How did you go? And when you start a new tour like that, when you record, is there some kind of anxiety regarding how the feedback of the audience?
Well, it's kind of it's hard for us to play the new stuff to begin with, especially because the new record is a little bit more challenging to play than some of the older ones. So that was the anxiety, I suppose, is making sure that we were able to play the songs properly and do a good job with it. But we've had our practice now, we've done a few tours, so that's all fine now, I think.
When you mentioned the fact that, it's difficult, it's kind of beginning to be difficult to write new songs, do you mean, technically speaking, to learn the songs?
To be able to play them live, some of these are quite tricky, technically to play.
So, right.
It took us quite a lot of rehearsal to get them right. But I think we have it down now.
Okay, do you need to use one way or the other samples, or it's you kind of modify or simplify the songs, or play them differently from the record or live?
We do them differently normally. We don't use backing tracks or anything like that. So if there's multiple guitar tracks, I just pick one and I just play the one I want to play. So it's different, but I think I quite like the live show being different to the record. I think it's cool. You know, when you come and see a band and it sounds different. So we embrace that and just do it differently if need be. And then some of it is pretty much the same if we can do it the same.
All right. To take a little perspective, maybe some of our readers never heard of Turbo Wolf. Can you tell us a few words about you? And it can be a kind of weird exercise. Could you kind of summarize the band in three words?
Strange and loud.
All right. It's something. All these key, I would say, these trademark from the start.
Were we always like this?
Yes. Yes.
I think we just have been doing what we like, and this is how it's come out. I think our only plan was to try to not be predictable and boring. So we're just trying to avoid that, really. Trying to avoid being cliched or repeating the past too much. And we didn't want to be the same as everyone else. So I think this is the only plan. And then the music that we make is just, it just happens because we're trying to be unusual and different.
All right. I think you're all from Bristol, most of you from Bristol?
Well, we all live there, None of us are actually from there, but that's where we live, yeah.
So from someone outside of the city, is there a special vibe in a city? Because, there's a... They used to be kind of what we call the Bristol sound with the Massive Attack, Tricky, Portishead. Is there kind of special artistic universe within the city?
Well, I think there's been a few different movements like that in Bristol. So there was the trip hop time, which is what you're talking about there.
Yes.
But that was before my time. I wasn't there then. That was, I suppose, in the 90s. And then there was drum and bass. There was a lot of drum and bass in Bristol in the sort of the late 90s and the early 2000s. But when we started doing our band, there wasn't really much going on musically. Like, certainly not in terms of guitar music. There wasn't really much. So, it was quite strange, really. We didn't really, there wasn't much of a scene. Now there is more, again. Like, the band called Idols, I don't know if you've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
They're from Bristol, and they're doing really well at the moment. There's a bunch of other bands around at the moment, so now it's cool. I think the best thing about Bristol was that it's quite a creatively open place. You know, you, in general, not even just with music, you know, you can be quite creative here, and you can be, I mean, there, and you can be quite strange and unusual, and no one minds. You know, like some cities, if you're like weird, you know, it would be. I don't know. I think Bristol is
welcoming
it welcomes weirdos. So I think that right, so that helps. You know, like we were allowed to be weird, and so we were.
So one way or the other, there's for consciously, I would say, don't you think there's any influence from the trip hop scene in your music?
No, none at all.
All right.
No.
Let's talk a little about your musical roots as a guitar player. Maybe kind of summarize your path until Turbo Wolf, and maybe either do you have like key references as musician or people you admire, artistically speaking, or?
Okay, well, I think when I was younger, I was influenced by the obvious stuff, same as everyone else, like Jimi Hendrix, Black Sabbath, you know, the usual sort of heavy kind of beginnings. And then there was a point, another key point in my sort of playing was I was getting really bored of guitar music. I found that everything, you know, in the sort of early 2000s, everything was kind of repetitive. I didn't really hear anything new. I kind of felt like maybe everything had been done. And then I encountered like a load of two-piece bands like Death From Above and Lightning Bolt and Hella and some of these strange two-piece bands that had like a really unusual approach to it. Like they were heavy, but it wasn't like heavy metal, or it wasn't really even like, you know, punk or anything. It was like heavy in a new, strange way. So that was a big influence on me then. Like I tried to sort of take the unconventional approach of these two-piece stripped-down bands, and a lot of that is in my playing now. Mm-hmm. And generally my favorite guitar players are usually the ones that are kind of really wild and not necessarily technically, you know, precise or technically the best. Like I really love like Neil Young and Jack White, I mean obviously Jimi Hendrix and stuff, but you know, I like people that sound like dangerous. They sound like it could go wrong at any moment, you know. This is the sort of thing I like, and I guess that's kind of how I play.
All right. If we come back to the Two Hands period in 2015, if you take the whole period from writing, recording, promo, tour after that, is there one souvenir, one event in particular that in your mind would sum up the whole period?
I think usually, well, there was a few. I mean, we did our first big tour of America. That was really amazing. Just driving through like the desert, you know, seeing America from, you know, the vehicle was incredible. But I think I found that our landmark events in both album cycles are usually our London show, because that's usually the biggest headline that we've ever done. So in Two Hands we did, where did we do? I think we did Islington Academy. That's, you know, for us was a big venue.
Mm-hmm.
And now for the new album we've just done the Scala in London, which is bigger. And it's just amazing for us to play these big venues and be the main act, you know, because we're so used to supporting other bands in sort of like big venues. So I think those are always the moments when we look around at each other and we're like, oh my God, you know, how has this happened? So I think those are usually the main moments.
Okay, in general, one or the other, is that a kind of an internal goal among you to one day to be able to, I don't know, to play the O2 or huge venues?
No, we don't have any goals, really, because I think being in a band, it's not like having a, you know, a career where you can aspire to a promotion. I think it's just chaos being in a band, and it could go wrong at any moment, or it could stop, you know, so we don't really think like that. We just take each thing that comes, you know, we just try and make the most of our opportunities. So our aspirations are really just like, you know, it was to make a good album, And now that we're touring, we just want to do a good job of all the touring that we can do. And then maybe we'll make some more music. It's very simple. We don't really sort of hope for any big goals, because I think it's hard to achieve things like that. You know, you just have to see what happens and just do the best you can.
All right. If I check the releases of your album, it seems that you kind of need 3-4 years to, between each release.
Right, yeah.
Is that, do you think, is your natural pace, or you kind of speed up, or it's business issues, or any other event that kind of slow the process?
It's kind of all of that, really. I mean, in the early, you know, between the first album and the second album, we did a lot of touring. So that delayed things. We didn't really start working on the album, you know, for quite a while because we were just touring so much. But we have, yeah, there have also been business issues for the albums, because we've changed label a few times, and, you know, that can delay things. And sometimes strategically, you know, we're advised to, you know, like, put it out at a certain point of the year is good, you know, so sometimes it might be ready earlier, but, you know, our management will say this is a good time. But yeah, we do spend a lot of time writing and recording, like a long, long time, because we just try and make every song good, and we try and make every part of every song good. We don't want any fillers, you know, or any bits that we're kind of disappointed with. So we just keep working on it until we're happy, which takes a long time. And then with recording as well, we spend a lot of time trying to get the right sound. You know, it's not a quick DIY sort of approach. It's not a quick, it's not like we record everything live and it's done, and we spend a long time like thinking about all the sounds and getting it all right.
Yeah, you don't switch the record on, you play an hour of music, you off, and then you release.
Yeah, we spend a long time. So, it takes us ages, but we're going to try and be quicker, I think, because, it's too long. We've taken too long, so I think we're going to try and learn how to be quicker.
It might be a cliche, but I have the feeling that, I don't know, in the 60s and maybe in the early 70s, the big bands, I have the idea of, it's the case for the Beatles, for example, used to release 2 albums a year, something like that, sometimes.
Yeah.
One way or the other, do you think it was crazy, or it just now how the business is organized, or all the structures are organized, it could not be done anymore?
Well, I think one thing about that is, like, when you look at albums from the 60s and 70s, they were a lot shorter. They might have had 7 or 8 songs on them. And they might have had, like, some cover songs, and they might have had some instrumental songs. You know, I think, it's not like they were releasing 12-song albums with every song is a song. But, I mean, but to be honest, like, it's amazing when I think about how much people produced back then, like, especially like a band like Creedence Clearwater Revival, you know, like I was listening to them, and their greatest hits album, so just the greatest hits, has got like 40 songs on it. And they were, I don't know how long they're around for, but not very long. I think less than 5 years, I think. I could be wrong, but not very long. And I'm like, oh my goodness, like, it's not like they made 40 songs, they made 40 amazing songs and all the other album tracks, that, you know, so yeah, it is amazing, all that stuff. But, you know, but when you're saying two albums a year, if you actually look at what those albums are, like, they're shorter, and there's a bit of filler in there, I think.
But don't you think there's maybe also unconsciously the idea not to go too fast, not to kind of dry up the creativity, or, you know... Don't you think one way or the other musicians could tend to slow their process because they fear they could not release... able to provide enough songs?
Yeah, I think sometimes there are definitely bands that I hear that I wish they would take more time. Like, some bands I'm like, yeah, your band is cool, but like, you're releasing albums so often, like, I don't have time to listen to them, you know, and there's a lot of filler.
Yeah, there's one or two songs you like, and the other you don't care at all.
Exactly, and then I feel like sometimes with those bands, like, I don't have the patience to listen to all their albums to find the few songs that I like, you know? So I've always kind of quite liked bands that, when they release an album, be like, right, I'm going to listen to this because I know they've put time into it, and I know it's going to be, you know, everything's going to be worth listening to. But, business-wise, it's better to release things more frequently, so I don't know. There's ups and downs to all of it, I think.
Okay. On the business side, I think I read that you first released 2 Hands on Spotify, for you make it available? No, I'm wrong?
No, I don't think so. No, it all came out all at the same time, I think.
So I kind of slightly modify my question. What do you think about this new trend to consume music, the all streaming stuff?
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? Because it's obviously amazing that we have almost every song that's ever been made at our fingertips. Like, that is just an incredible resource to have as a listener. But I think it is a little bit... The fact that music is so accessible means sometimes people won't spend as much time with a record, and they might miss elements that would have grown on them. You know, like, I think, like, when we were younger and you had to buy it on a CD, and once you bought it, you wanted to listen to it because you paid, you know, some good money for it, you would spend the time and maybe you would find things in these records that, you know, you weren't apparent until you'd listened to it 10 times.
Yeah, the second or third or fourth layer.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes I've found that the songs that I didn't really care about to begin with, after I've heard them 10 times, they're my favourite ones, you know, and they stay with you. So I think it's a shame, because I think a lot of people probably will miss out on that now. They'll give things a quick listen. They might not even listen to the whole album. They'll just listen to half of it, and then they'll put on something else because they have everything at their fingertips. So I think from a listener's point of view, that can be a bit of a shame. And certainly from the point of view of being in a band, it's, you know, I mean, it's very difficult to sell albums at the moment, because, you know, people can just listen to them, they can stream them, or they can steal them, you know. So it's financially a huge problem for everyone. So, I mean, I hope that the streaming services... basically more money can come to the artists. It's causing a big problem, and I see a lot of great bands end because they can't make any money, and they've made these great albums, but they're not able to continue because they can't make any money from it. So obviously, I mean, everyone knows, it's obvious that that's a huge problem, and I hope that that changes.
Okay. If we come back to the Free Life, what can you tell us in general about the recording sessions? And in particular, did you modify one way or the other your way of working compared to Two Hands?
Yeah, this was really different, actually, because we did most of it ourselves. Myself and the singer, Chris, did almost everything in our houses, actually. So we have a really good friend, Tom Dalgetty, who's a great music producer. He's done, like, Royal Blood and Ghost and Rammstein and the Pixies, like, lots of big stuff. And he's our friend. He recorded Two Hands for us. So with this album, with The Free Life, we wanted to have more control ourselves because we had a really strong idea for it, for how we wanted it to sound. And Tom was really busy anyway because he was working on a lot of big projects. So he helped us make it ourselves. So he recorded the drums for us in a proper studio, because we don't understand how to make drums. That's very difficult, you know. So he did that for us. And then we took the drums away and we recorded everything else just in my house and in Chris's house, which was really cool because we had, like, you know, all the time we wanted to experiment and to try unusual methods. Because normally you can't do that because you're paying for studio time or you're paying a producer or, you know, so we had as much time as we wanted, which was great. And then at the end of all that, we got back together with Tom for a few weeks to mix it, and so he could just check that we hadn't made any huge mistakes or anything, you know. So it was really good. Yeah, we had a lot of control. I mean, we went completely insane because it was just myself and Chris in a room for months making it, so...
Okay, but don't you think it could become the fact that it can experiment as much as you want, take the almost as much time than you want, could be a trap? Because when don't you say stop?
Yeah, well, definitely. I'm definitely guilty of that. I think the thing was, there was a date booked when we had to mix it with Tom, because he was only available for a certain time. So we had a date where we had to go and mix it. So whatever we had then was the end. So that was good, I think, that we had to just stop.
So you need these deadlines?
Well, I mean, I personally don't like having deadlines, but my manager and everyone else tells me I have to.
For sure. Okay. You started to mention it. So, how the creative process work within a band? You came with a structure, or Chris come with a structure, and then you work together, and then with the band, or How does it work in internally?
So usually I write all the music myself. So I usually start off with some rough ideas. Like I might make them on a guitar or a keyboard, or maybe I'll plan out some drums on the computer. So I'll get some vague ideas together, and I'll sort of keep experimenting just on my own until I have an idea for the music for the song. And it might be quite simple at that stage, just like maybe just guitar and drums, or synth and drums, or whatever, you know. So I'll experiment until I think I have a good starting point. Then I give this basic beginning to Chris, and he experiments with vocals over the top of it. Then we get back together and we have a look at what we have there, and we have opinions on each other's elements, and we just keep working together then until we have the basic music and basic vocals, like, you know, the chorus, the verse, the main riffs, all the main bits. And then for this album, then we tried to get all the songs in that stage where they weren't finished, but we had the main blocks of them, and then we finished them all together so that we didn't repeat ourselves. And, you know, so if we were like, well, this song, we want to keep it short, that means this one can be long, you know, and we sort of made the album all together and finished it, like, as one big piece. So with the drums, like our drummer Blake, he's a really great drummer, and so I take him computer drums I've made with the basic ideas, and I go, well, this is the idea. And sometimes he'll play exactly the same as I wrote it, or sometimes he'll change it and make it better, you know, because he's a great drummer. So, yeah, and that's it, really.
Okay. How would you rate your efficiency, I mean, creatively speaking, about all the bits and pieces you have? What's the share of these bits and pieces that will become songs? 20%, 50%, 80%?
Tiny percent. I'll be experimenting with an instrument or whatever, and I'll record little videos on my phone of guitar or bass or synth or anything, you know. Sometimes I'll just like say an idea into the camera, and I have all these little videos, and then I put them into my computer in folders. So I have like riffs, I have like lead guitar, like weird bits, you know, synth bits, have all these like categories, and I just go through them and pick ones I like. But there's like so many that never get used. I probably used about, I don't know, 0.5% of them, maybe less. But like, so okay. Much stuff that's okay. Not used. But most of it's rubbish.
But why do you record videos of your ideas and not just audio tracks?
Yeah, I used to do audio, but I don't know why. I don't know, it's much easier for me to, I don't know, consider the video. I mean, partly I can see what I'm playing, which helps when I have to remember what it was. But also, I find audio files, for some reason, I don't know, quite difficult to listen back to. I don't know, I guess it's a different, yeah, I don't know.
One way or the other, when you have to browse through ideas, good and bad, and for what you say, mostly bad, it's more, I would say, entertaining to have videos than just sort of audio tracks?
Maybe. I think it's less annoying for some reason. I don't know why. Okay. I don't know why it is, but I found it really annoying going through audio files, whereas videos, it's still annoying, but it's not as bad for some reason. I don't know why.
All right. Another element which from my point of view is important is the visuals. How did you work the cover picture from the Free Life?
Yeah, I made that myself. Yeah.
And you also designed the one for Two Hands?
Yeah, I've done every bit of Turbo Wolf artwork, all the T-shirts and all the albums, all of it.
And for the new record, do we have to kind of an enigma to find any hidden ideas about the figures of the crocodile, the figures of is there some hidden messages we have to find, or?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I don't like to describe things. I think it takes away the magic if you tell the story. So, I mean, I think yeah, it's just there for people to consider themselves, and they can form their own opinions, and it's a mixture. Some things do have a meaning, and other things are there to just create like an atmosphere, you know, that I think is fitting to the, you know, to the music or to the record, you know. So it's a mixture. Okay. I can't explain it.
And are you yourself like a graphic designer, or you? It was the DIY idea that okay, it will cost less money if I do it myself.
I've just always done it. Yeah, I mean, I do some art. I don't do much because I don't have a lot of time. But I do like screen printed posters sometimes. Like I'm just working on one for Queens of the Stone Age at the moment.
Uh-huh.
And I do a bit of stuff. Like I've made some T-shirts for Royal Blood because they asked me. So just a few little bits and bobs. But I do some of that. I'm going to try and do some more, I think, once we're not touring. But yeah, I do like screen print artwork and stuff like that. So, but yeah, with Turbo Wolf, I just had to do it myself because I didn't trust anyone else to do it, you know, because it had to fit the band. And I kind of thought that if I have to explain to someone else how it should be, I might as well just do it myself.
And so it's the same philosophy for the video clips?
So
say the new one, which is pretty psychedelic.
Me and Chris made the very latest one for Cheap Magic. We made that one, and mm-hmm. it's quite basic, that one. You know, that's the only video we've ever made. We just did that because there was no money for anyone else to make it. But all the others, they've been made by directors. I mean, we have a lot of input normally. You know, we'll talk to the directors a lot. We have ideas, and, we have a lot of, a lot of it comes from us. But, it's the actual directors making the videos.
Okay. What could we wish for to Turbo Wolf for the future? So as you mentioned, there's the upcoming US tour.
Uh-huh.
What would you like to see in the coming weeks or months for you and the band?
Well, we're just going to be playing a lot of concerts now. We have the US tour starting in a week, and then we have some UK festivals, and then hopefully in autumn this year, we will do a big European tour.
Headlining?
No, it's not confirmed, but I think we're going to be supporting a band.
Okay.
And if this does happen, then we're coming to France. It's certainly a Paris date. I don't know if there's another one. There might be more. So that would be cool. That would be great to get back into Europe. And I don't know, we're just going to play a lot of shows, and then, try and work on some more music, you know, just the usual stuff.
Okay. And just the last question, just with your perspective, how do you see the, if you have an opinion on the British rock scene?
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard to say, really. It's hard to get an overall view of it all, but it feels to me at the moment that rock music is not doing so well in England. In the UK, I think a lot of the younger music fans, they really like electronic music and grime and things like this at the moment. I think guitar music is not as much in favour. I mean, of course, there are a lot of bands doing well, but I think things like grime are doing much better. Like, the kids love that at the moment.
My feeling is that it's like in UK, like in all European countries, or even in the US, it's kind of the end of an era. You have the huge bands, we are getting older and sometimes disappear, like Motorhead, because some of the members are dying.
Yeah.
So you have the case for, so Black Sabbath stopped, you have the case for Judas Priest continues, but you don't know how long.
Yeah.
Iron Maiden will be the same. And you don't see a new band that could reach such level?
I think it's because, like, since the internet came around and there wasn't so much money from record sales, bands don't have as long a lifespan, so they don't have as much time to become a great band. If they're not a success, you know, in the first album or two, then they get dropped. And because no one's buying albums, even like a good band might not sell many records, so they get dropped and they can't make any money and they have to stop. So I think it's hard for bands to exist long enough to become great. And I also think that the bands that do make money and can continue are often are often less interesting, because I think it's the interesting bands that need more time and maybe won't make a lot of money on the first album or two, you know?
You don't see, for example, imagine a band like, I don't know, King Crimson,
Yeah.
You don't see how they could now rise and...
Yeah.
They will be, like, it's too, would be too a niche market or too weird for the...
Yeah. Like, there's loads of bands that are as good as that, but they can't become big legendary bands because they can't make any money, so they can't survive. So they have to stop. And because there's no money, there isn't enough money to promote them properly, to, like, expose them properly. You know, so I think a lot of great bands die away, and a lot of less good bands, they're easier to
market.
They're easier to market in the short term, so they make money. So a lot of the bands that do keep going, I personally think are often less interesting. But you know, so they're able to survive, but they can't become a huge legendary band because they're not good enough. So it is a tricky time. Definitely, I think if artists can start making money again, if streaming services start paying artists properly, then that could save everything. So we have to see what happens with that, I think.
So on this joyful touch, I thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure.
Great, thank you too. Thank you for being interested.
And take care, and hopefully see you soon in Paris.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.